You're listening to Season 2, Episode 20 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes in New York City and online and have built an incredible writing community. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation within the Writers Society. Oh my gosh, I've been so anxious and excited to finally share today's episode with you. For all the Game of Thrones fans, I'm sure by now you know about the Dothraki and Valyrian languages, but did you know that a linguist was hired on professionally to create them? And we're talking about fleshed out languages that are fully functional in the real world outside of Game of Thrones. We have none other than the awesome David J. Peterson on the show with us today. David is a conlanger who's created languages for HBO's Game of Thrones, Marvel's Thor: The Dark World, and multiple other TV shows. David is also the author of his newest book, The Art of Language Invention, where readers can learn technical how-tos and advice about inventing their own languages. We have a special giveaway contest for this episode. Game of Thrones fans, you're gonna love this, so you might want to pay special attention to this part. Three lucky winners will receive a signed copy of David's book called Living Language Dothraki and a limited edition 88 Cups of Tea mug. All you have to do is pay attention to David's episode, write down what you loved most about it, and share it on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Don't forget to tag at 88 Cups of Tea and include hashtag 88 Cups of Tea so we can find your contest entry. Deadline is Wednesday, June 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that's 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. In today's conversation, we get super technical about how David builds and constructs languages, the evolution of languages, why Arabic is David's favorite language he's learned, and of course, we take a closer look at the Dothraki and Valyrian languages he invented for Game of Thrones, and a whole lot more cool language-related stuff. So let's jump right in. Hey guys, oh my gosh, we have David Peterson with us here today. David, how are you doing? I'm so pumped to have you on the show. What's up?
Oh, nothing much. Just chilling at home. My wife has taken the young baby to meet her aunt to Downtown Disney. So I have quiet for a little bit.
That's awesome. Congrats on your beautiful baby, by the way. I saw your Vine and your baby is gorgeous. So cute. And your cats are so cute, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So David, I know that you invented the languages for Game of Thrones. Super quick side note, I know you're also a fan of cats, of course. Did you watch the YouTube video of the cats meowing to the theme song?
Oh, of course. My goodness. I mean, cats doing anything is amazing, but that was was adorable. I loved it.
That's brilliant. So, David, I'd love to know, how did you first get into the creation of languages? Like, that is so fascinating.
When I was a junior in high school, I became very interested all of a sudden in learning languages. And so I decided to It's basically one morning right then to learn as many languages as I could. And so I started studying French on my own, and then I took German in high school in addition to taking AP Spanish, which I was already taking. And then I started studying Latin on my own. And then when I got to Berkeley, I saw that there were a number of language offerings available. So I took two semesters of Arabic, a semester of Russian, a semester of Esperanto, and a semester of French. And I took those my first three semesters. And then my mother suggested to me that I take a course in linguistics, which I wasn't as interested in because linguists don't learn languages, they just study them abstractly. But I took it anyway to humor her. And I really fell in love with it, both because it was just very different from everything that I was doing at the time as an English major, and because I found it very easy. It was just a lot of fun. And so I started majoring in linguistics, but it was during the first course that I hit upon the idea of creating my own language. And I thought that I was the first one to come up with this idea. The only created languages I'd heard of before that were languages that were created for international communication, which just didn't seem realistic to create something like that at this point. So I thought, okay, I'll create a language that just I can use with friends or with my girlfriend. And I started to create it basically the moment that I had the idea. I just started creating it right in my notebook that I was taking notes in for class. And I kept up with it for the next 16 years.
Wow. Okay, so I know you mentioned that you took all those other languages your first 3 semesters. How
Yeah.
quickly do you learn languages?
It's not really very difficult, especially if you're engaging with language in the format of an introductory language course. I swear, the first semester, anybody can do it standing on their head, especially if it has some sort of a different writing system, because honestly, they'll probably spend the first 2.5 weeks trying to teach you how to write the writing system. So if you just learn that beforehand, which it's not that hard to do. And in fact, I got really good at taking the first semester of a language course. I mean, it's just memorizing and then practice. Practice is the one thing that it's very hard to do if you're just on your own, but it's really easy to do if you're taking a course. Because first of all, you have a native speaker there, or hopefully you have a native speaker there who's teaching you that you can practice with to perfect your pronunciation and just, to say stuff over and over again. So you kind of develop some muscle memory for it. And there's also homework and stuff, so you get to write it. So you get all of that, and of course you hear it all the time, which is another thing that you don't get with books. So you get all of this practice just developing muscle memory so that you're comfortable speaking it, you're comfortable hearing it, and it happens every single day. And you're working for a grade, so you're extra motivated to do it. So I really, really like courses in that way. Even so, the beginning stuff, it's not that hard. It's not that difficult. You start with one tense, which is usually the way it works when you're studying a language. You can get that down pretty well. It's not a super hard challenge. Taking a language and learning it to fluency, that is a big challenge. But just getting in there and getting your feet wet, just getting enough to get by in some other country, it's not too taxing. It's something I think that we should all do, like daily. Everybody at every point in time in their life should have some sort of a language project on the side that they're just trying to learn. Because, I mean, there's so many of us on this planet, and not everybody speaks English.
That's true. That is very true. So, how many languages at most, if there was one point in your life where you were quite not fluent, but like conversational?
Yeah, 6 or 7
Wow.
that I could do a little bit. Like if you drop me in the country, I wouldn't die. I think 6 or 7.
And which of those languages were your favorite to learn?
Oh, my favorite to learn was definitely Arabic. I loved learning Arabic. Just a beautiful language. Worked in a way that I never imagined a language could work. It just never occurred to me that a language could even be like that. And so it was a lot of fun.
How was it different, like the way they put the words together, or?
Well, the closest we can get to it, if you think about regular verbs in English, what's a nice strum, like with a stringed instrument. So you have strum, strums, strummed. There's still an identifiable chunk strum in there. You're just adding stuff to the end. Compare that to something like write, wrote, written. So from write to wrote, there's nothing added to the end. There's something that happens internally. And then from write to written, there's both something that happens internally and there's a new piece of phonological material on the end. There's a suffix there. That's more what Arabic is like, except that you can expand that out from the verbs to also the nouns. So it has a series of these roots, most of which are triconsonantal, that has three consonants that appear in the same linear order no matter what you're talking about. KTB is the most common one, ktaba. So from that root, you get kitab, which is book, kutub, which is books, maktab, which is office, maktaba, which is library. Then you have verbs like aktub, I write, yaktub, he writes, kataba, he wrote in the past tense, katabat, she wrote in the past tense, katabtu, I wrote in the past tense, and so on. That's how the entire system works for every single verb. It would be like every single verb was irregular the way write wrote was, except that irregularity is regular and it happens with all the verbs and it goes from both the verbs to the nouns. It totally blew my mind and I absolutely fell in love with it. I thought it was amazing.
Wow, and how long did it take you to learn Arabic? I'm assuming because you love it so much, you might be fluent in it, not just conversational.
No, I'm better at it with everything than everything else. But no, I took 2 semesters of Arabic and then I stopped. I had to make a decision. Once I discovered linguistics and I was doing other things, I had to make a choice about if I wanted to continue on with Arabic and eventually say, you know, like double major in it or do something else. And I decided to do something else that I wanted more variety as opposed to mastery in one. I wanted to take more languages. It didn't help that the next semester of Arabic was being taught very early in the morning.
You
I wasn't excited
just did
about
not want to
that.
get up.
I didn't. And so, yeah, so rather than continue on with Arabic, I started taking other languages. And honestly, I wish I would have taken more. That's my biggest regret about leaving Berkeley. There were so many language offerings. I could have taken Turkish, I could have taken Finnish, I could have taken both Hindi and Bengali and Marathi. Those were all offered. I could have taken Swedish, I could have taken Chinese and Japanese. I could have taken so many languages. They were all offered there. I just wish I would have
Whoa,
taken.
that's amazing. I think I only had like Spanish, Chinese, Japanese, and French, and possibly German in my college. And I think that's it. Like, your languages are so badass. That's so cool that they offer it there.
Oh, I know. And you know, I took Middle Egyptian hieroglyphs while I was there. You don't get that
What?
opportunity everywhere. Yeah.
What, are you, there was a course in that? Are you serious right now?
Yeah,
What?
and I took it. There was no way I was not taking it, of course.
Hell yeah.
I know. I was shocked actually that I would tell people that I'm taking this course and their reaction wasn't, "Oh, let me sign up for that too." I was like, "You don't get that opportunity everywhere."
That's insane. Like, if I saw that course, I'd be like, boom, signing up ASAP. Okay, so now we got into this world, and I'm so fascinated because I'm assuming right now this is your full-time job, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct.
I didn't know that this is something that could be a full-time job. So you went to college, you studied those languages, and you studied linguistics as well. Did you already have the goal that you would be applying for jobs as a linguist?
I went in as an English major with the intent of teaching high school English. And once I got to linguistics, I was just doing it for fun. I didn't even know what you did for jobs in linguistics. And then once I started creating languages, that was where I learned that not only were there absolutely no job prospects for language creators at all, language creators were roundly ridiculed and derided for creating languages the world over, within academic linguistics, but also just within regular society, and that had been the case for decades. So not only were there no job opportunities, I was quite certain that there would never be any. And certainly, I mean, considering that I'm the first person ever to have a full-time job creating languages, no, I didn't think that I would be the first person in history to ever have such a job.
Whoa, okay, so how did you transition from it being a hobby over to it being like a job?
As a language creator, one thing I did was I was a part of the Conlang Listserv, which was an online email-based forum for language creators. And I was there for 5 years before some guy who actually was also a Berkeley undergrad decided he wanted to do a conference. And so I decided to be a part of the conference because I figured it was going to happen whether I helped or not. And so that was what we did. I was one of the speakers at the first language creation conference in Berkeley in 2006. And we held the second one in 2007. In 2007, there were three reporters that came to the language creation conference at Berkeley. One of them was Amber Dance, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who did a story that was largely not about the language creation conference a few weeks later, which was kind of disappointing for us. Another was Joshua Foer, who years later would do a story on John Quijada and his language Ithquil and how it was picked up by a group of Ukrainian terrorists. And he did that story for The New Yorker. The third reporter was Erica Okrent. Erica Okrent was working on a book at the time, a book that would come to be called In the Land of Invented Languages. And while she was there, she interviewed a number of us. She watched the conference. And then her book actually came out 2 years later in 2009. In 2009, that was when Dan Weiss and David Benioff got the green light from HBO to do an internal pilot based on the Song of Ice and Fire books, which they had optioned. And so as they were doing it, they realized that a big chunk of that first episode was going to be this wedding between Khal Drogo and Daenerys. Because it was going to be for the screen, they realized that they're going to have people speaking Dothraki. Because while you can just get by with narration in the books, you actually have to have people speaking that in the show. So they didn't know how to find somebody to create a language at this point. So what they did was they saw that Erica Okrent's book, In the Land of Invented Languages, was getting some press. And so they contacted her. Erica Okrent, through her connection to the Language Creation Society, who put on the Language Creation Conference that she attended, sent Dan Weiss and David Benioff to the Language Creation Society. And then the Language Creation Society put together a contest that they announced to all language creators. And I applied with about 40 others. And then after two rounds of judging, I was the one that the producers chose. So that's how that whole thing happened.
Wow, that is so awesome. I noticed that for Dothraki, when they're speaking it, there's almost like an aggression to the way they speak it. Do the producers come to you and say, hey, can you create a language where it represents the people?
Well, given the nature of the competition, we didn't work with them. They just chose the one they liked. But even so, you have to understand that when watching the show, the reason that you hear a lot of aggressive languages, it's because there are a lot of aggressive situations, because that just happens to be the way of it with that storyline. There's a lot of strife when you hear Dothraki, but it's not a harsh language, and it certainly doesn't need to be, and it isn't always. One of my favorite scenes actually was from season one, where there's a discussion between Jorah and Rakaro, and they're just having a discussion about kind of the difference between Westerosi knights and then Dothraki warriors. And there's a little bit of code switching that goes on, which I really like, which is kind of cool. As Jorah's speaking both Dothraki, but also a little bit of English with Dothraki mixed in, kind of teaching Rakaro a little bit of English too. And they're just having a very nice, very manly conversation about what it's like to go into battle, what the differences are, how the Westerosi knights have advantages in certain ways, Dothraki warriors have advantages in other ways. We hear about Rakaro's father and why he wants to grow up and become a great warrior. But it's not angry or aggressive at all, and it doesn't sound harsh. Honestly, it sounds very nice. And there are a number of scenes like that, especially in the first season, where you have more tender conversations between Daenerys and Drogo. Because, you know, a language is just a language. It can sound angry if the person who's speaking it is very angry, or it can sound gentle if the person who's speaking it is being gentle, you know?
True. How do you find that distinction between the Dothraki and the Valyrian? Are there any inspirations, references? Did you have to refer to the book just for a little bit of inspiration? How did that creation process work for you?
With Valyrian, it started with the phrases Valar Morghulis and Valar Dohaeris in the books. And it was from that that I derived basically the number system for the nouns and the entire verbal system for the language. And both those words, and then also just the ton of names, because there are a ton of names that are either Valyrian or Valyrian-like in the books. And all of those were very informative when it came to the type of sound that George R. R. Martin was going for in his books. And I thought it was very distinct, consistent, and I guess evident. It wasn't like you could mistake a Valyrian name coming through the books. They had a very specific, unique character to them. And so I just tried to follow in his footsteps and create a language that sounded like that. And I think it worked out for the most part. I'm really pleased with how High Valyrian came out. That is, in how similar it feels to what's in the books.
So when you're making these languages, do you base your languages when you invent them off of these already made languages, like a certain blueprint?
No, you don't need to. You can just build the languages up. And then if they resemble other languages in the end, it'll just be by happenstance rather than by design. That's kind of the way I go about it. There are two main distinctions in language, head initial and head final, that is whether the most important part of a phrase is going to come first or second. And it's a major divide in languages. And those that do one versus the other tend to look more alike than those that do the opposite. So it's like Turkish and Japanese look very, very similar in many regards, despite the fact that they're totally unrelated. Versus, like, for example, Japanese and Tagalog. Those are spoken in close proximity, but look totally different, almost backwards even. Whereas Japanese and Turkish, you know, not related, totally far away from one another, end up looking very similar in a lot of ways. And so that's just something that happens. Just be a natural evolution, just by the fact that these languages are evolved in such a way that if you're always putting in the most important part of the phrase and the sentence in the same spot, you tend to hit upon the same solutions for the same problems. I think the term for it is convergent evolution. That is, you could have two things that grow up in entirely different environments without any connection to one another, and they end up doing a very similar or the same thing in order to solve a problem, because it's just the most natural thing to do, I guess, in that regard. So it's happened a number of times. Like, I didn't study Japanese till last year, but a few years prior to that, I had created a language, a very strong head final language, which I hadn't really done before. And so this was Castathan for a show I worked on called Defiance on Sci-Fi. And so, you know, when it came to doing relative clauses, they were very backwards from the way that English does it. And so Yeah, based on my own knowledge of how languages change over time and what I was trying to do, I was like, okay, this is what makes sense for how relative clauses work. And so I just did it, and then the language was working and went on like that. Went to study Japanese a few years later, and when it got to the section teaching, the reader how to do relative clauses, I was like, oh, I know how this works, because it just happens that the thing that I created worked in a very, very, very similar way to Japanese, because the headedness was the same, that they were both head final languages. And so, because there are a limited number of parameters, ways in which languages can differ, you're undoubtedly going to run across things that just happen to be the same as another language, but it doesn't necessarily need to be by design. And in my opinion, it's better if it's not, because then you're working with your own data, with your own evolution. You can make sure that the systems that you evolve work in a very specific way, very particular to that strain of evolution, so that it wouldn't work exactly the same as a different language that has a similar structure that evolved from different lexical material. So, in other words, you're sticking with what you got and making sure you're being as faithful to your own project as possible without needlessly or unconsciously borrowing from other sources.
How long does it usually take on average to create these fully functional languages?
As long as I'm given.
How about a time that you're comfortable with where you don't feel stressed out?
Especially if I don't have other projects to focus on, 2 to 3 months. That's what I'd like. Before I started working in Hollywood, I would say 6 months to a year. That was how I felt, at my most comfortable. But, at that time, of course, I was always doing something else, whether it was another job or whether I was at school. So I had something else that was the most important thing that I was supposed to be doing. Since language creation is now the most important thing I'm supposed to be doing, aside from childcare, 2 to 3 months, feel pretty good with that. Any time that, oh God, it just kills me. Like, I was just doing a recent project where I was assured I had to have 2 to 3 months, and I was right on that schedule. Everything was going very well. And then it's like a month in, they're like, okay, we just need some translation a little bit right now. I'm like, no. It's like, but it's okay. Like, if it changes later on, I'm just like, oh, twist the knife. It's like,
Blasphemous.
yeah.
I guess you have to deliver, like you said, because you're being
Yeah.
paid for it. But what do you do? It doesn't sound like you like to do shortcuts. You want it to be
No.
fully fleshed out, which is really admirable. But in those unfortunate cases, what do you do?
Well, here's the cost-benefit analysis, because the thing is, you can do it very quickly. Like, very quickly, especially now, I can kind of just write it down and get an idea for what I'm doing. The difference is that, let's say you said, here's some random sentence translated into a brand new language. I could do that making it up on the spot, where I could just look at it and see, okay, I have an idea about how this word would evolve. Here's what the root would look like. Let's make up some sound changes in my head. Let's put together some grammar. It's like there's one tense in this sentence, so let's figure out how that tense would have evolved. And you can just kind of do it in the course of a couple hours. The difference is that when you go to translate the next one, you haven't written down any of that stuff that you did all in your head. And
I
so,
see. So it's creating your own rules and being able to
yeah.
follow it. I see. Okay.
It's kind of like you're just tying your own feet together, because it's like the second that you go on to sentence two, and then three, and then four, because I mean, I'm only coming on to these projects when I'm doing, like, between 10 and 20 lines of translation an episode, right? The more you do, the more you're going to make mistakes if this stuff isn't written down and very precisely explained. And if the words aren't precisely explained and their etymologies aren't written down, this is like the busy work that, nobody sees, but it's what keeps everything consistent. It's what makes it feel like an actual language, because it is an actual language. If you just do it and then don't write anything down, later on down the line, you will have made a mistake. You will have forgotten some rule that you made. You'll break your own rules. The grammar is going to look like one way in one episode, and then another way in another episode, and it's just going to be a nightmare. And eventually, the fans will discover it and call you out on this. I know this because they do. I mean,
Oh,
I've seen
shoot.
it. I mean, usually what fans are calling me out on is when I forget my own grammar, because that happens. God, I made grammar errors in the first two episodes of Game of Thrones, and it kills
My
me.
God, God forbid, please. Like I speak English and I make grammatical errors all the time. Like, I
I
mean,
know.
come on, you just invented a freaking language.
I blame my young daughter.
but she's so cute.
And blame it on your cats.
There we go.
The cats did it.
Just on that same note, what do you find is most frustrating when creating languages?
Yeah, the most difficult part, and also the most frustrating part actually, is creating a verbal system. And there's a very specific reason. So this is if you're creating like a naturalistic language, so one that's supposed to be spoken by humans, one that's evolved over centuries. You know, if you're just creating an auxiliary language or something like that, you just say, all right, there's the verb system, and that's the way it is. But if you're evolving a verbal system, verbs are super fickle. Not like nouns. Nouns change meaning very slowly, and the systems change very slowly as well. And also, the systems tend to be very simple. You know, number morphology, whether something singular or plural, even throw in a dual, whatever, it's fine. Noun cases, they'll have variant uses, but they still have a basic use. It's fine. It's very solid. Verbs are extremely fickle. The way that tenses are used changes from generation to generation. Like, it can change that quickly. I mean, I'm just talking about the languages that we speak. It's so baffling. It just keeps you on your toes. It's like, if you just dip into a language every 20 years, you'll notice little variations in how verb systems work. In English, for example, we learn that a certain set of conjugations are the present tense. So I eat, you eat, he eats. We learn that that's the present tense and that's what it's called. It's called the present tense and we use it in the present. But it's just not true. I mean, it was probably true at one point in time, probably when they came up with the term present tense. But if you talk about how we talk about things that are happening right now, we use the so-called present progressive tense. So it's like, I'm talking right now. What are you eating? You say, what are you eating? You don't say, what do you eat?
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, like, despite the fact that it was created as a present tense, it's not really the present tense anymore. How do we use it? In fact, if I asked you that, what do you eat? What would your interpretation be?
I eat food.
Yeah. So, like, that's exactly right. Your interpretation is that I asked you, what do you eat regularly, habitually, you know, or what do you enjoy eating? That's the interpretation. So what we've really done there is use the verb in a habitual sense, as opposed to the present tense, even though that's what it's called. So, like, that's the key difference between what do you eat and what are you eating. But that distinction, it's not as if we just have to do it over and say, okay, all right, now this thing that we used to call the present progressive, now it's the present tense. And the thing we used to call the present tense is now the habitual tense. That's not the way it works. Because then it does get used as the present tense sometimes. Like, what do you like to do? I like to go go-karting. I mean, it's the present tense, but also kind of a habitual act. And then there's this bizarre little tense, which I call the counterfactual hypothetical, which is used in sports a lot. So you hear it in football all the time. There is some sort of magnificent play. This guy, like, you know, gets the ball and runs all the way to the end zone. And then when they're going to the replay, the guy will say something like this. He'll be looking at the blocker and say, he doesn't make that block right there, then he doesn't get to the end zone. It's like, that was the present tense, but what it meant was, if this guy had not have had done this, then this guy would not have done that. Yeah. But you just use the present tense. And it's like, you know that that thing must have come to exist like the past 50, 60 years. It's brand new. It's not even like when you study English as a second language, they sit you down and it's like, okay, now this is how you use the present tense in these bizarre counterfactual situations if you're describing replays in sports. You just have to learn it. So going back to a language creator, think about having to create that garbage. It's like you're creating all of these tenses and giving them all these names and knowing that, all right, these are the names of these tenses, but that's not how they're going to be used. And I have to invent how these things are going to be changing because they're going to be changing so quickly, like within generations. And you have to figure out all of these varying uses of these tenses and actually apply them to people of different ages, depending on where, you know, how old they are. And, you know, how formally or informally they're speaking. Creating verbs is the most difficult thing to do when creating a language. And it's also the most important part.
Oh, man, that sucks.
All languages are built around their verb systems. Like, it's what drives the entire language.
Okay. Huh. That was a lot. Thank you for going into that. Holy crap. I'm like,
Sure.
geez, they better be paying you good for this. Let me tell you, my goodness. I feel like my brain just got tossed into the washing machine and just like, whew. You know, in your book, The Art of Language Invention, that was the first time I learned that J.R.R. Tolkien was a language creator before he wrote books. I had
Yeah.
no idea till I read that part in your intro. And you mentioned that he was actually the first to invent the family, like you use the word family of
Yeah.
language. Do you mind unpacking that a little bit for me and the listeners? Yeah, what did you mean by family of languages?
Sure. First of all, though, I also like to say that I find that very refreshing that you didn't know that Tolkien created languages, because I didn't either. I didn't learn that Tolkien created languages until I started meeting other conlangers, and they were talking about Tolkien like he was, some amazing figure. I'm like, he's talking about that Hobbit guy? I'm like, this is like, everybody grows up knowing Tolkien a little bit, but I had no idea that he created languages. But yeah, it turns out he's like the patron saint of conlanging.
Of course, I'm assuming he studied linguistics as well.
Yeah, well, the European version of linguistics, philology.
Oh, is that super different?
Kind of, but not really. I mean, it's the type of thing where it's like in America, you don't find philology departments, and in Europe, you still find them. Philology
Interesting.
was more focused on the historical change of languages. I mean, it's not exactly the same as historical linguistics, which is what we call it in the United States, but it's close to that. Like, they were more focused on, how are these various related languages, how are they similar, how are they different, how do they change over time? That was what Tolkien specialized in, how sounds changed over time in the Indo-European family. And he did study that. Yeah, so he was a philologist, an academic philologist, and it was that tradition that inspired him to create the languages that he did the way that he did. And so a language family is this. You have Latin, for example. Everybody knows Latin. The languages, French, Spanish, Romanian, Italian, and Portuguese, all of those descended from Latin. So basically what happens is people that spoke Latin, Vulgar Latin, went to these other areas and, conquered them. And that became the language that people used there. And then eventually it changed over time. And over time became a totally unintelligible language. So that, both French and Spanish started out as Vulgar Latin. And then, just through regular use over the centuries became two new languages. And these language families exist all over the world. There are a few isolates here and there, like the Basque language spoken in Spain is an isolate. But other than that, you will find languages that are related that came from some other language. Like, for example, Japanese and Korean are related in a similar way. And then there's like an entire family of Sino-Tibetan languages, so that Mandarin and Cantonese are obviously related, even though they're different languages. So some of the biggest families are like, Austronesian, Sino-Tibetan, Indo-European, Bantu. There are tons of related languages in Africa because Bantu, kind of similar to Indo-European, it took over a lot of places. Bantu speakers started in a small area in Africa and spread out over a huge area in sub-Saharan Africa. So you find lots of different related languages like that. The way that these languages are related, so you have this word like mater in Latin that meant mother. And then what happened is over time, the sounds changed so that T in between vowels became D in Spanish. And then there was a flip in the ER became RE. So what was mater in Latin became madre in Spanish. At the same time in French, the T became a D in between vowels, and then the D was just lost, and then so was the sound at the end of the word. So mater became mère. And you can see very similar things happening in the other languages. So that's what it means to have a language family. It started off as one language, and then basically evolved into separate things. So Tolkien, as far as we know, was the first one to do that as a language creator, where he created an old language and then evolved languages from it with regular sound changes like that and some meaning changes as well. That approach, we call it the historical method, and it's something that language creators do now and have gotten pretty good with, in fact. But as far as we know, Tolkien is the one that pioneered the approach.
I'm really curious. J.R.R. Tolkien went into writing fiction. Do you ever have like a thought of perhaps creating fiction?
Well, that's actually where I started out before I got interested in learning languages, even.
Yes, you mentioned that you were studying English.
Yeah, and there was a reason for that. You know, when I was 16 years old, that was when I started writing. I started writing short fiction. And then when I was a senior in high school, that was when I wrote my first novel. I finished my second one when I was a freshman and in college. After that, I switched over to writing short fiction again in college. I was very fortunate. I got to take one of the three writing classes they have at Berkeley because they only had three.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was
Oh my God, they have a
poetry.
million languages, but they have three
Yeah,
class
I
one.
know. There's an entire creative writing major at UC Davis. At Berkeley, there were three writing courses. There was poetry, and that was the whole reason I went to Berkeley's English department. I heard it was so good, so I thought, oh, yes, cool, I'll get to write fiction. I was like, no. Anyway, so yeah, they have poetry writing. They have long narrative nonfiction. That's another course.
Okay.
And then the third one was short fiction. And obviously, these things are very highly impacted. There are only a couple every semester. So you have to apply to get in. I applied and got in. It was taught by the author, Bharati Mukherjee. She was Indian and then, you know, came to live in Britain. And she wrote books like Jasmine, she's very famous for. And so I was very fortunate to take that course. And my writing improved a lot then. I was writing short fiction. And so I kept up with that. I eventually went back and wrote another novel. I finished it in 2009 just to see if I could still do it. And I could. I was very pleased with the writing. I haven't produced anything yet that I'm really happy with. So, I mean, that is where I'm moving next, though. I'm trying to get back to writing because that's a weird thing. Everybody knows me for language creation. I just keep
Right.
thinking of myself as the writer from high school who wants to get back to it. That's where I'm headed next. It's been tough because I've been busy. I mean, in the span of a few months, we had our first child, we moved into a new house, my wife got a new job, and I started working on three new television shows.
All very good things.
All good things, not conducive to just sitting down and writing, but that's where I'm heading next. So
You'll get there. You will. You
damn
have more
straight.
time.
I'm
But
saying it on this podcast so that it will happen and I can hold myself to it.
keep you accountable and we'll check back with you next time you're on the show again. It's going to be about your book, your fiction, okay?
All right.
But the other books that you did work on that you wrote for yourself, that you finished your novels, what kind of genre were they?
First one I finished, it was a personal achievement. It was a science fiction dystopian novel that was very clearly and very strongly inspired by Brazil, a little bit 1984, and maybe Brave New World and like Pink Floyd.
Ooh.
If you describe it that way, it sounds like it could be interesting, but I mean, it was not written well and not very good. So, and it was especially, there were certain things that were really just way too derivative of Brazil. Brazil just really captured my imagination at that age. It was just too in my head. I couldn't write anything different. So that was the first one. The second one was inspired by James Joyce. It was nuts. It was a very bizarre little project. A guy would walk into a store and look at an orange in the produce aisle and then relive his entire life in random order, in random snapshots, mixing in both memories and also things that he'd seen on television and read. And then with his memories actually changing over the course of time so that you wouldn't even know which one was true or not. And that lasting 300 pages. I did it, but it was not good. I don't think it was a worthy project. Or maybe it was a worthy project, but it was not one that a writer like me was capable of handling well. So I did that and I finished it and it was fine. The third one was, I still stand by, because this is the one that I finished in 2009. I still stand by the writing. I think the writing is very good in there, but I absolutely just completely fell out of love with my idea and
Okay.
just do not like it at all. I don't think it was a story that needed to be written, frankly. And
Well, tell us
so,
how you really feel.
yeah. And so it's like, you know, at that point, it was like, all right, I did it. The writing is good, where it's like, you know, 7 years later, I'm still proud of the writing. So it's like, fantastic, you did it. But there's no reason anybody needs to see this novel. Maybe if I have some sort of biographer 140 years from now or something, they can look at it and say, well, this is what he was thinking back then. It's really, it would be only interesting for some graduate student doing a project.
I wonder if in the future, whenever you are ready, if you will be weaving in any kind of new language that you invent. But if not, all good. You're still awesome and you're still writing a book. With your work of creating languages, how many years has it been about?
16.
Just from the beginning to the end, how have you evolved creatively throughout the 16 years of creating languages. Have you noticed a change?
Oh God, like head over heels. Honestly, I could give you an hour long answer to this. I'll try to give you the short ones. But I'll tell you this, for older language creators, and when I say older, I mean before 2009, before Avatar came out, before Game of Thrones came out, a lot of language creators independently invented the idea of creating languages. In my case, I'd heard about Esperanto and languages for international communication, but never languages for any other purpose. So I thought that I was the first one to ever invent a language for, you know, personal use. Like I said, I didn't know about Tolkien. I didn't know about the thousands of others. Lots of language creators started that way, where they hadn't heard about somebody else. They just started creating their own language and thought they were the first person to do that. Something happens when you encounter other language creators for the first time that I think is, or at least was, unique to language creation. Because it's like, if you start painting as a kid, it's not like you're going to think there's no such thing as other painters. I mean, there's a huge tradition and everybody talks about it and knows about it. So you're going to know that you're one of millions. As language creators, when you meet other language creators for the first time, it's both exciting that you have people to talk about this with and super disappointing because you realize you're not unique. And because of that, it's like you take your work and you start to look at other people's works and you see that it's different. The natural reaction is like, well, but they're not as good as I am because I know me. That was me. That was me as a young language creator. I was like, okay, but even though there are other people, I mean, I'm obviously the best at this.
Let's be real.
Yeah. And so it took a while. It took like a year or so for me to really fully understand that this first language I was creating was really, really, really bad. Irredeemably bad. And I didn't know why it in those early stages, but I figured it out eventually. It's like, it was the language had no purpose, and so it was trying to serve a whole bunch of different masters. It was trying to be natural in one sense, trying to be an oxling in another sense. It was trying to be just something I liked in one sense, and then I was just trying to do things I thought people would like in another sense. It was a mess. And not only that, I discovered that I was replicating the English vocabulary. And it's like, I think the best way to make this point is to tell you that in this first language, there were two entirely separate roots for sailor and mariner. Think about that. They're two different words in English, but they're two different words in English because they come from two different traditions. You know, mariner was something that was borrowed from the Romance languages, and sailor comes to us from our Germanic roots built in the usual way. And it just so happens that's why we have those two different words, because we borrowed a lot of influence both from Latin and the other Romance languages, especially French, in the history of our language. That's why we have those two words. But they both essentially mean the same thing. So by creating two entirely different words that had the definition sailor and mariner, all I was doing was replicating the exact vocabulary of English, while at the same time completely cutting off the history. It was senseless. It was pointless. And so I realized this as I was going through and doing this and realized, oh man, I've created a unique grammar, which I did, but I'm just creating a really weird way to speak English. I mean, and so from then, at that point, it was like I would start a new language project every single time I realized that the one I was working on was irredeemable. I left off that one, started a new one. Then I realized, oh, wait, I'm not doing things quite right here. So I left off that one, started a new one. And I kept that up for several years until I got to graduate school, I think. So a key point for me was first taking John McWhorter's Pidgins and Creoles classes. And that was where I really started to learn just what it means to take lexical material and evolve something new from it, how people look at language and make new stuff out of it. And then I'm going to graduate school studying lexicalist morphology and figuring out how it is that people interact with language, how they actually use it, what it actually looks like in the mind, and that it didn't look the way that I thought it did, the way, in fact, that I had been taught in my previous linguistics courses, kind of threw that out. So that was a big change for me, and I started a different approach that I'm still more satisfied with today. I'm still getting better, But that was the last really big change. And where I realized that in order to create a language that's going to look real, you have to evolve it. You absolutely have to evolve it. That's the only way to do it. You're going to be, you know, simulating that evolutionary process. But I mean, since we only live for so long as human beings, I think that's the best we can get at it.
I hear the word conlang. Do you mind explaining a little bit about conlang, what that means to listeners? So I'm sure I don't know if one listener out there really knows the meaning of conlang and the conlang community.
Conlang is short for constructed language. And that's the word for a constructed language. And so then somebody who does it is a conlanger. The word actually came from needing a name for the listserv. So, you know, the listserv was going to be, you know, x@y.com, right? And mm-hmm. so we needed the x. And they said, well, let's just shorten up constructed language. And so it became conlang at where the listserv is housed, which is listserv.brown.edu. So that became the name for the listserv. And then people started using it to talk about the languages, calling them conlangs and calling us conlangers, the activity conlanging. There were other terms at the time, planned language, model language, artificial language that people used. But conlang was the one that eventually won out just through consensus. And then last year, in fact, it was added to the Oxford English Dictionary.
Now it's
the word.
Well, congratulations to y'all. That's awesome. And what about those like listeners who are realizing, wait, I like creating languages. What do I do now? What do you want to tell them?
Well, the first place that you can go online is conlang.org. So it's just the word that we've been talking about, .org on the end. And that's the website for the Language Creation Society, which has links to everything on the web that has to do with language creation. So it has links to every single community, and there are communities in different languages too, not just in English. And also print resources, web resources, anything that you can imagine you can find starting there. For books, linguistics is very helpful, especially certain aspects of it. Things like synchronic analysis, less so, but basic introduction to linguistics can't help. And there are print resources to do that, but also the Wikipedia for linguistics articles specifically, not bad. And they're pretty good. There are groups of linguists that work with them periodically, so that's not a bad place to start. Also, for studying languages, just type in name of language, grammar. Oh, so much good stuff on there. And then the idea behind my book, The Art of Language Invention, was to give people a print resource where they could just start. So like if you don't know anything, you can start there and kind of dive in. So hopefully it serves that purpose. I've also got a YouTube channel that's called The Art of Language Invention, where I go over smaller little bits in more detail.
So that kind of is like an add-on to your book. It goes deeper?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's awesome. So after you had your book published and it was out there, have you noticed like a lot more linguists reaching out to you, asking you about the community and asking you about constructing of languages overall?
Yeah, and not only that, I kind of see myself as an ambassador from conlanging to linguistics, because like I said at the beginning, there were a lot of negative reactions from academic linguistics, but also the general public.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the first ever book written about language creators was written in 1986, I want to say, and it was called Lunatic Lovers of Language, and it was basically just a book-long rant saying how these people are crazy and should be jailed.
What?
Yeah, by Marina Yaguello.
Do you possibly know where that stemmed from?
I have two theories. One from academic linguistics. First of all, academic linguistics has always had to fight itself off from other disciplines. Linguistics itself is pretty young, and it always seems to get kicked around by the other departments saying that, oh, it's not serious. And I think that the reason behind that is everybody speaks a language, so everybody thinks of themselves as a language expert. And so often, like, the actual findings that linguists make are kind of dismissed. They're saying, like, ah, I speak a language. I'm pretty sure I know what I'm talking about there. The other thing is that I think people think of language as a tool and little else. So it's like the idea of creating a language that nobody speaks seems crazy. It's like the whole point of a language is supposed to be that, you know, you use it to communicate with others. So if you're creating a language that nobody else can communicate with, people think, well, why have you done that? Why have you done this crazy thing? Whereas what I've been trying to show people is that language creation is really just an art form, like no more or no less. So it's not as if we're creating languages and say, all right, everybody needs to speak this instead of whatever language you speak. I mean, it's just silly. No, they're things to be considered and engaged with so that you can see essentially what we've done how we've created a new communication system, the choices that we made, the stories that we tell and the etymologies that we create. It's just a different type of art form that you can engage with in several different ways. And it's nothing that needs to be feared, I guess. So part of what I do now is I give a lot of talks at linguistics departments or at universities sponsored by linguistics departments. And essentially, I just show them what it is that we do and why it's interesting and also why it's not a threat to linguistics, which is just, I mean, they think that. I mean, less and less every day, but that was the idea. And it's like, I don't know. And so now linguists are turning around and seeing the utility of it. They're seeing that people are really interested in this, that it helps them engage with language and linguistics in a different way, in an artistic way. And so now a lot of linguists are turning around and saying, okay, how can we incorporate this into our introductory courses to get students engaged and to get them thinking about language in a different way? So it's cool.
Brilliant. What is the proudest moment in your career?
Oh, man.
You're like, girl, everything.
No, I have several. It was like some of it is interpersonal stuff. Like I remember one of my proudest moments was in Defiance, where one of the actresses, she texted me and asked me to translate a line for her because she wanted to ad-lib it. Because like it was originally written in English and she thought it should be in one of my languages. So like she ad-libbed it because she said, if I do it on set, they'll just go with it. You know, there'll be no choice for them at that point. And that was just... that was Nicole Galicia, by the way. Absolutely loved her. She's amazing. That was one. But just like for an on-screen moment, it's definitely episode 4, season 3 of Game of Thrones, when Daenerys reveals that she speaks High Valyrian. It was perfect. And not only that, it was one of those memorable moments of Game of Thrones that isn't horrifying, but it's triumphant, you know?
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of those. A lot of the memorable moments are really, really ugly.
Oh, my God, like the Red Wedding? Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
I'd never watch that again. I would never watch that again. It's very well done.
And I could just hear cats in the background. Meow, 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 meow. You know what? That reminds me really quickly when you mentioned High Valyrian. I also read that there's Low Valyrian, which actually I did not realize. Could you explain the difference between the High and Low Valyrian? Because I thought it's Valyrian.
Yeah. Well, that's the way they see it on the show. Like in the world, they just call it Valyrian.
Yes.
What they don't realize is that they're actually two different languages in the same way that Vulgar Latin and Old Spanish are two different languages. So Low Valyrian actually derived from High Valyrian, and we get to hear both on the show. So you actually see the language family on the show. It's really fun.
Oh, David, you're so awesome. Jeez. Okay, so let's wrap it up. What is one or a few of your favorite books that you can recommend to us?
Here are a couple. First of all, for language creation, one of the most transformational books for me was a book called The Evolution of Grammar by Joan Bybee, William Pagliuca, and Perkins Revere. That completely changed the way that I looked at language. So that was hugely, hugely foundational for me. Definitely not one you can just jump into without some background knowledge, but it was a great one. And then just fiction. God, I have so many. But like one of my favorites was a recent favorite was Orlando Furioso, which is this crazy, fantastical romance from, I want to say, the 1300s. And it's interesting for two reasons. One, it's just basically, you know, knights going off and battling monsters and stuff in actually a super fantastical way with magic and everything. But also, like, there are really four main knights, four main characters, and two of them are male and two of them are female. And you don't really see that a lot from literature from the 14th century. You have these two entirely different, really badass female warriors. And it was a lot of fun to read.
Damn, that's awesome. I'm like thinking of Xena and Mulan all of a sudden.
Marfisa and Bradamont.
Nice. I'll have to check that out.
And then, I mean, I could keep going. Fathers and Sons by Ivan Turgenev always gets me. Anything Virginia Woolf ever wrote, because Virginia Woolf is the greatest writer of all time.
Yes, she is. Bless her soul. David, that's amazing. I'm going to have those listed on your show notes page. And let us know where we can find you on social media to say what's up.
Yeah. So on Twitter and Tumblr, I'm Daedalus, D-E-D-A-L-V-S. It's spelled like it was Latin. That came from Stephen Daedalus, by the way. That was I got that little handle. So I'm pretty active on both Twitter and Tumblr. And then I also have my own website, artoflanguageinvention.com. And you can go from there to my YouTube or Tumblr or Twitter. It's got links to all those.
Perfect. David, you've been freaking awesome. Thank you for diving in and unpacking everything. You are badass. FYI, just so the fans know, David is super close to his family. You seem to be super close to your sister. sister as well, because I see you doing shout-outs on Vine. I love that, because I'm super close to my family, especially my two youngest sisters. So when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, dude, I have to talk to this guy even more now. But that's amazing, and I love it, and I love that you're there with your baby, your newborn baby, being an awesome dad too. So props to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That wraps up our episode with the brilliant David J. Peterson. Listeners, thank you so much for listening in. For a list of resources and books that were mentioned in today's episode, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/David J. Peterson. Storytellers, if you liked today's episode, please let me know on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and you can find me at 88 Cups of Tea. And be sure to say hi to David over on Twitter at DEDALVS. You can find his Twitter account linked on his show notes page as well. I've been loving your messages and emails about the podcast and have been listening to what you're looking for. A lot of you have reached out asking about writing communities and classes, and I'm so excited to tell you more about Gotham Writers. If you're working on your own fiction, whether it's a short story or a novel, or even in genres like mystery, romance, science fiction, and fantasy, I really want you to listen to why Gotham is an incredible asset to writers. They started in my favorite city of all time, New York City, my home where a lot of my dreams came true. Just like me, Gotham believes that everyone has a story to tell, and they exist just so they can help writers like you tell your story better. You learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshopping, Gotham will show you how to shift from reading stories to creating them. Gotham teaches all the elements of craft to strengthen your techniques and skills. Gotham even has an acclaimed book on craft called Writing Fiction. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham will also introduce you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of heart and soul into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Gotham Writers to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.